content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. All right, our first article is called Joe Biden Has Won the 2020 Presidential Election. After a period of uncertainty, the race has finally been called. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been elected the next president and vice president of the United States, 4 days after Election Day. Enough ballots have been counted in key swing states for news outlets to call the 2020 presidential election in the Democrats' favor. Harris will be the country's first woman vice president, as well as the first Black or South Asian politician to hold office. Throughout the day's long wait, Biden indicated that he believed he would ultimately prevail, but asked that Americans be patient while states counted every vote, a process that was predicted to take longer this year, given the increase in mail-in voting and other changes to the electoral process amid the pandemic. Democracy's sometimes messy, Biden said on Thursday. It sometimes requires a little patience as well, but that patience has been rewarded now for more than 240 years with a system of governance that's been the envy of the world. Trump took a starkly different tone, repeatedly alleging foul play without evidence and tweeting statements like "Stop the fraud" and "Stop the count." Twitter affixed a label to such tweets, declaring their content disputed and misleading. On Thursday night, he spoke to the public in a misinformation-filled White House address, baselessly claiming that the other side was trying to steal an election. His campaign has also filed lawsuits and procedural challenges in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Judges in Michigan and Georgia have already ruled against its legal challenges, but the campaign did get a small victory in Pennsylvania when a judge allowed poll watchers to move closer to those counting. It does seem like they're throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks, which I tell my law students is never a good strategy, Joshua Douglas, a University of Kentucky professor and election law expert, told NPR. Despite all of this, major news organizations, including CNN, The New York Times, and the Associated Press, feel it's now clear that Biden has won the Electoral College, with Pennsylvania recently being called for the Democrats. The results come after a contentious campaign and an election season like no other, with states rushing to make voting safe amid an unprecedented pandemic, in part thanks to the circumstances which led some states to open up access to mail-in ballots and early in-person voting. The electorate set a record for early turnout. By Monday, according to the U.S. Elections Project, over 96.2 million votes had already been cast, a full two-thirds of the total ballots cast in 2016. The total turnout also set a record as the highest in modern history. On Wednesday, NBC News projected that at least 159.8 million Americans cast ballots in the election, which would mean that 66.8% of the eligible population voted, the highest percentage since 1908. And now I'll read you an article called "With a Historic Win, Kamala Harris Will Be the First Female Vice President of the United States." Kamala Harris is officially the next Vice President of the United States, cementing her place as the first woman, the first Black woman, the first Indian American, South Asian, and Asian American person to hold the position. While this moment is particularly historic, Harris is used to blazing her own trail. In her career, she was the first Black person and the first woman to become California's Attorney General. In 2016, she ran to represent California in the U.S. Senate and became the state's first Black senator, the country's first South Asian American senator, and only the second Black woman to be in the Senate. She also used to be Biden's competition, one of a record number of Democratic women who ran for president in 2020. During her speech at the 2020 Democratic National Convention, where she accepted the nomination for vice president, Harris spoke about her place in politics. She said, "That I am here tonight is a testament to the dedication of generations before me. women and men who believed so fiercely in the promise of equality, liberty, and justice for all. Biden and Harris will officially be sworn in on January 20th, 2021, marking the end of the Donald Trump and Mike Pence administration and a start of a true sea change in the executive branch. In her recent cover story with Elle, Harris reflected on when Trump won the election in 2016, the same year she was elected to the Senate. "I had one way in my mind I thought the evening would go," she said. "And then there was the way it turned out. And so by the time I took the stage, I had ripped up my notes, and all I had was my godson, Alexander, in my heart. And I took the podium, and I said, I intend to fight. I intend to fight." And sticking with the political theme for a moment, I'm going to read an article called "Oprah Reacts to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's Election. The Soul of America Gets a Reset." There's a photograph showing Oprah arm-in-arm with Joe Biden, and he's grinning. Oprah wrote that while political differences were leading the headlines ahead of the election for the 46th president of the United States, there was a lot more for Americans to consider. Beyond all the policy issues that will matter most in the future, the economy, climate change, health care, social security, education, what's really at stake are civility, decency, humanity, she wrote. The hatred that's been unleashed will take some reckoning to overcome. Now, with the election of former Vice President Joe Biden as our nation's next president, Oprah believes that we have taken a step in that direction. After President-elect Biden and his Vice President-elect Kamala Harris gave moving acceptance speeches in Wilmington, Delaware on the evening of November 7th, Oprah took to Twitter to share her reaction. "And so we rise, as Maya would remind us," she wrote, nodding to "Still I Rise," a famed poem by her friend and late writer Maya Angelou. Character rises. Decency rises. The soul of America gets a reset. And it starts now. Hashtag #BidenHarris. In October, Oprah invited the now president-elect to take part in a town hall for OWN's Own Your Vote campaign. Biden joined the call with Oprah, who was speaking with Mildred Madison, a 94-year-old voter. Madison went viral when her son drove 600 miles from Illinois, where she has been living during the pandemic, to Michigan, so she could vote during the state's early voting period. "You're so inspiring. Hearing your story gives me that extra boost of hope and energy and optimism for the country," Biden told Madison, noting that she reminded him of his own mother. "I said we're in a battle for the soul of America. You are the soul of America. You're everything we stand for." In a separate town hall, Oprah also took to Zoom with Kamala Harris in a joint event with her sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, and an audience of members of other historically black sororities, Delta Sigma Theta, Sigma Gamma Rho, and Zeta Phi Beta. On the call, Harris surprised her sorority sisters with an appearance. "Think of your vote representing you, representing your family, representing the ancestors, and also representing people around the country," she said. "As for our team here at OprahMag.com, we're joining our O of O in celebrating the rise of decency. Congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris." This next article is called "Alex Trebek Spent His Last Day with His Wife, Jean, As He'd Always Wanted." The Jeopardy host said he wished he'd met her sooner. As Jeopardy host since 1984, Alex Trebek was a pillar in the pantheon of American game show icons. His professional yet warm-hearted manner made him a beloved personality who became so familiar on our TV screens after more than 35 years that it almost felt like we knew him. When the cameras were rolling, Trebek made it seem like he could read off clues and announce daily doubles in his sleep. But in March 2019, he revealed that he'd been living with a stage 4 pancreatic cancer diagnosis off-screen. On November 8th, 2020, Trebek died at the age of 80. The day after Trebek's passing, Jeopardy! Executive producer Mike Richards told the Today Show's Savannah Guthrie that he'd gotten to spend his last day with the love of his life, wife Jean Trebek. He had a swing in his backyard he loved. He actually rebuilt it earlier this year, Richards said, adding that Trebek was notoriously handy. Even in his book, he described that he wanted his final day to be sitting on the swing next to his wife Jean, kind of watching the horizon, Richards continued. And he got to do that. He was coherent, he was not in pain, and the fact that he had a nice final day makes all of us in the Jeopardy! Family feel that much better. In a March 2020 video update on his journey, Trebek had shared that there were some good days, but a lot of not-so-good days. He went on to say that his spouse had inspired him to keep going when he almost felt like he couldn't. Because that would have been a massive betrayal, a betrayal of my wife and soulmate, Jean, who has given her all to help me survive. Trebek's widow, Jean Trebek, is a professional Reiki healer, a native New Yorker who he met in 1988 and married 2 years later. His only regret? Not meeting her sooner. Here's the couple's longtime love story. Alex Trebek met Jean, a sound healer and Reiki master, at a party in 1988. According to Newsweek, the pair met at a party in New York City, and they got along right off the bat. He later invited her to his home for a first date dinner. The nerves were real. I was afraid I'd mispronounce my own name, but Alex is really down to earth. He's much more casual than he is on the show, she told People. Alex proposed to Jean on her 26th birthday with a sapphire ring. In September 1989, Alex gave his girlfriend a birthday present, black velvet pants and a bolero jacket. I thought that was it, she said. And then he said, oh, here's a little something else. And he took out this little wicker box. Inside, according to People, a 16-carat sapphire surrounded by diamonds. It took my breath away. I mean, it was a rock. Needless to say, she said yes. They married in April 1990. Per People magazine, Jean said that she and Alex remained just friends for a while after they met given their age difference, as she was more than 2 decades younger than him. There was just this deep sensitivity about him with a gruffy exterior, she said. I kept thinking, he's 24 years older than me. But there was something that just kept drawing me to him. Eventually, that something would draw her all the way down the aisle as the two married in April 1990 in front of 150 guests at LA's Regency Club. 3 weeks later, she was pregnant. They had 2 children together. Though previously married, Alex didn't have his own children, Matthew Trebek, 30, a Manhattan restaurateur, and Emily Trebek, 27, a Los Angeles realtor, until marrying Jean. He did, however, adopt his ex-wife, Elaine Calais Trebek's daughter, Nikki Trebek, while they were together. Jean and Alex described themselves as home buddies who loved watching movies in bed. I was never into going out into clubs. It just wasn't my scene, Alex told People. A fellow home buddy, Jean, said she loved watching movies after dinner with her husband in bed. Alex also mentioned that he liked to tinker around the house, taking things apart and putting them back together. We can all learn a lesson from Alex here. If it ain't broke, take it apart, put it back together, then go watch a movie with the love of your life. Jean used her sound healing to help comfort Alex. In an interview with SurvivorNet in November 2019, Jean shared details of how her profession helped herself and Alex remain uplifted during his cancer treatments, saying that the universe will always respond when you ask for help. It comes from a place of love, because I want to uplift him. And when I keep my own self buoyed and enjoying my life, I can actually share that with him. He can look at me and have a sense of, life is beautiful. My wife is doing something good, she continued. She'd ask him to take a break from Jeopardy. In a January 2020 interview with Good Morning America, Jean confessed that she had asked Alex to take a break from hosting the game show. But I know it's what feeds him. He loves doing Jeopardy. He has his own family over there. They are such a close-knit, beautiful group of people. I think it gives him a lot of support, a sense of purpose, and he's not just in bed and he can be productive. It's always tough for the caretakers because she has to deal with her worrying about my well-being and also dealing with... I'm not always the most pleasant person to be around when I'm experiencing severe pain and depression, and she has to tread lightly around me, Alex said. Looking to the end of his career as Jeopardy host, he told Newsweek, I will say my goodbyes and I will tell people, don't ask me who's going to replace me because I have no say whatsoever. But I'm sure that if you give them the same love and attention and respect that you have shown me, then they will be a success. And the show will continue being a success. And until we meet again, God bless you and goodbye. When speaking with People magazine around the time of his 2019 diagnosis, the game show host got candid about life with his wife. I'm pretty satisfied with my life, he said then, admitting that he did have one regret. But my wife, Jean, and I have been together almost 29 years, and I was thinking about President Bush when he died, and all the comments about his life, about what a nice guy he is, and how he and his wife have been together 73 years. I thought, oh my gosh, if I had just met Jean in my 20s, we could have had a longer life together. This next article is called Stacey Abrams Has Written 8 Romance Novels Under the Name Selena Montgomery. She's a politician, lawyer, voting rights activist, and successful author, too. Former Georgia candidate for governor, Stacey Abrams, is now earning much-earned recognition for her work to help turn the state purple in 2020. Georgia has gone Republican in presidential elections since 1992, but record voter turnout has seen over 2.4 million votes for presidential candidate Joe Biden, giving him an extremely narrow lead over President Donald Trump. In the past 2 years, Abrams has worked tirelessly to recruit voters of color in Georgia, helping to register an estimated 800,000 since 2018, according to Newsweek. Another humble fact about the voting rights activist, she's a successful romance novelist, having written her first book, Rules of Engagement, during her third year as a student at Yale University. Under the pseudonym Selena Montgomery, the politician penned 8 books with the last, Deception, published in 2009. She also wrote a memoir in 2018 and is gearing up to release the political thriller While Justice Sleeps in May 2021. The act of writing is integral to who I am, she told Washington Post in 2018. I'm a writer, politician, a tax attorney, a civic leader, and an entrepreneur. I'm proud of what I've accomplished. Her romantic suspense novels include the love stories of a lawyer and sheriff, 2 undercover agents, and a sexy ethnobotanist, all with the goal of illustrating that black women can be as adventurous and attractive as any white woman, she told the Washington Post. Telling a well-crafted story is hard, full stop, she said. Regardless of genre, good writing is good writing. Romance is one of the oldest forms of storytelling, and I'm honored to be in the company of extraordinary writers. So, if you're as interested in her imagination as you are her politics, you can find a full list of Selena Montgomery's books below. And they are Hidden Sins, Secrets and Lies, Reckless, Deception, Never Tell, Rules of Engagement, The Art of Desire, Power of Persuasion. Okay, this next article is called The Winter Solstice Will Be Here Before You Know It. We all have our ways of coping with the winter months, whether that's binging comfort TV shows, planning creative dates, or even orchestrating a safe getaway. But there's always some confusion as to when exactly winter technically begins, since the weather typically starts changing long before the winter solstice arrives. In the United States, the official start of the season happens on the winter solstice, which this year will take place on December 21st, albeit at different times across the country. Occurring just a few days before Christmas, most people are long into their cold weather routines and they may not even realize that this special day is taking place. We've put together some facts about this annual occurrence so you know when it happens in your area, what the phrase winter solstice actually means, and the difference between a solstice and an equinox. Now remind me, what is the winter solstice? The winter solstice is an annual occurrence when the sun is at its southernmost point in the northern hemisphere. The winter solstice is commonly known as the shortest day of the year, when there's the least daylight, and it means that the North Pole is the farthest from the sun. In the southern hemisphere, the winter solstice occurs in June. The first day of winter is December 21st, 2020. Winter will come to the northern hemisphere on December 21st at 5:02 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, per the Farmer's Almanac. That means it'll take place at 2:02 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 3:02 a.m. Mountain Time, and 4:02 a.m. Central Standard Time. Per timeanddate.com, the southern hemisphere winter solstice will occur on June 20th, 2021 at 11:32 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The solstice and the equinox are not the same thing. Nope. And according to Encyclopedia Britannica, they are sort of opposites. Because the planet rotates on a tilted axis, different locations receive varying amounts of sunlight as the year progresses. The solstices mark the days at which the path of the sun travels farthest north or south from the Earth's equator, which is why the winter solstice is the shortest day of the year, and the summer solstice, conversely, is the longest. The equinoxes, which take place in March and September, are the moments in the spring and the fall where the sun is directly above the equator and daylight and nighttime are relatively equal. Traditional celebrations have marked the winter solstice for centuries, and some continue to this day. Historically, many cultures around the world have celebrated or acknowledged the importance of the winter solstice, and there is significant mythology around it. Per National Geographic, ancient Egyptians built the Temple of Karnak in alignment with the winter solstice, and similar tributes can be found in Cambodia's Angkor Wat or Peru's Machu Picchu. According to History.com, past celebrations of the winter solstice include Saturnalia, the Roman celebration that ultimately became a week-long party with gambling, grand meals, and gift-giving. In China, Dongzi honors the solstice with traditional Chinese dishes such as rice balls and meat dumplings, while also being an occasion for families to gather. In contemporary Iran, as well as countries like Afghanistan and Tajikistan, Shabi Yalda is celebrated on the solstice, and that's a gathering for people to protect each other from evil, per history.com, which is connected to it being the year's longest night. Shabi Yalda, which means night of birth, includes wishmaking, the eating of nuts and pomegranates, and poetry readings, specifically by Persian writer Hafez. In England, roughly 5,000 people gather at the site of Stonehenge each year for the solstice celebration and to watch the sunrise, which is organized by local pagan and druid groups, though it's unclear how the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic will affect these planned events. Even more gatherings occur in places like Scandinavia, with the St. Lucia Day, which technically happens on December 13th, which is their traditional solstice day. It features large bonfires, ornate robes for young women, and sharing baked goods. The beauty of the winter solstice is that you can acknowledge it however you want, whether that's by participating in a time-honored celebration or simply burrowing a little harder into your couch. All right, this next article is called Blue Ivy Narrated the Audiobook for Matthew Cherry's Hair Love. The 8-year-old's resume just keeps growing. At the age of 8, Blue Ivy Carter is already following in her parents' footsteps. The oldest daughter of Beyoncé and Jay-Z has already won a BET award this year, becoming the youngest person to do so, and captivated audiences in Beyoncé's film Black is King. We're still not over her Find Your Way Back appearance. Most recently, the budding star, actually make that full-blown star, narrated the Audible audiobook for Hair Love, an acclaimed children's book based on Matthew Cherry's Oscar-winning short film. Cherry announced the news on Twitter, along with a sample of the 4-minute-long audiobook, currently available to purchase. Hair Love follows the ups and downs of a dad taking care of his young daughter's hair for the first time. Per the publisher's description, Hair Love is an ode to loving your natural hair. Cherry, a former NFL pro who wrote and directed the movie, was inspired by a viral video of Daryl L. Hines and his young girl. A couple years ago, I was coming across a lot of viral videos about African-American fathers that were doing their daughter's hair, Cherry explained on Good Morning America. It really seemed like it was an anomaly. People were really sharing it because they weren't used to seeing it. I just wanted to normalize it and kind of shine a light because oftentimes black men get a bad rap in not being involved in their kids' lives. And I really wanted to showcase a strong black family unit and show that dads are present. Hair Love, co-produced by Karen Rupert Tolliver, the executive vice president of creative at Sony Pictures, will also have a future on television. Variety reports that the story will be developed into an animated TV show at HBO Max called Young Love, based on the characters from Hair Love. Maybe Blue Ivy will reprise her role as Zuri, the story's main character in the HBO series. Based on the joyous reactions to the surprise audiobook casting, people are ready. Being able to hear Blue Ivy give voice to this masterful story is so awesome. They try to bury us, not knowing that we are seeds of strength and beauty, Gabrielle Union wrote on Twitter. And now I'm going to read some autumn poems. The first poem I'll read is Nothing Gold Can Stay by Robert Frost. Nothing gold can stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold, her early leaves of flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today, nothing gold can stay. Ever wish the weather outside always complimented your mood? Dreary weather for dreary days. Emily Bronte, author of Wuthering Heights, longs for bad weather in this poem, Fall Leaves Fall. Fall leaves fall, die, flowers away, lengthen night and shorten day. Every leaf speaks bliss to me, fluttering from the autumn tree. I shall smile when wreaths of snow blossom where the rose should grow. I shall sing when nights decay, ushers in a drearier day. All right, romantic poet John Keats waxes poetic, literally, about the scenery of the fall season in this famous poem, To Autumn. Keats progresses through the stages of the season from ripening fruits to increasingly cold nights, displaying an appreciation for every moment. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too, he writes. And that's all I'm going to read of that one, because that is quite a long poem. Sonnet 73 is undeniably one of William Shakespeare's more melancholy sonnets. Shakespeare compares fall to the aging process and reflects upon growing old. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang, upon the boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all the rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereupon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. And now I'll read The Heat of Autumn by Jane Hirschfield. The short poem takes a surprising turn midway through, brilliantly applying the season's changes to human love and all its varieties. The heat of autumn is different from the heat of summer. One ripens apples, the other turns them to cider. One is a duck you walk out on, the other the spine of a thin swimming horse, and the river each day a full measure colder. A man with cancer leaves his wife for his lover. Before he goes, she straightens his belts in the closet, rearranges the socks and sweaters inside the dresser, by color. That's autumn's heat. Her hand placing silver buckles with silver, gold buckles with gold, setting each on the hook it belongs, in a closet soon to be empty, and calling it pleasure. Next is Perhaps the World Ends Here by Joy Harjo. The world begins at a kitchen table, Joy Harjo's poem begins. Perhaps the world ends here is a meditation about the cycle of life and the moments where we slow down and take stock of our days, our years. The world begins at a kitchen table, no matter what we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it, babies teethe at the corners, they scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it, we make women. At this table we gossip, recall enemies and ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor falling down selves, and as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate a terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite. Okay, Gwendolyn Brooks invents a new meaning for the word autumn in her poem, A Sunset of the City. It is summer gone that I see, it is summer gone. The autumn weather around her is a convenient metaphor for the arriving at the middle age phase of her life. And here's the poem. Already I am no longer looked at with lechery or love. My daughters and sons have put me away with marbles and dolls. Are gone from the house. My husband and lovers are pleasant or somewhat polite, and night is night. It is a real chill out, the genuine thing. I am not deceived. I do not think it is still summer because sun stays and birds continue to sing. It is summer gone that I see. It is summer gone. The sweet flowers in drying and dying down. The grasses forgetting their blaze and consenting to brown. It is a real chill out. The fall crisp comes. I am aware there is winter to heed. There is no warm house that is fitted with my need. I am cold in this house whose washed echoes are tremulous down lost halls. I am a woman and dusty, standing among new affairs. I am a woman who hurries through her prayers. 10 intimations of a quiet core to be my desert and my dear relief. Come, there shall be such islanding from grief, in small communion with the master shore, twang they. And I incline this ear to tin, consult a dual dilemma, whether to dry, in humming pallor, or to leap and die. Somebody muffled it? Somebody wanted to joke. And the last poem I'll read for now is called First Fall by Maggie Smith. First Fall, written from the perspective of a parent taking her infant for a walk, has one of our favorite poem endings. I'm your guide here. In the evening dark, morning streets, I point and name. Look, the sycamores, their mottled paint-by-number bark. Look, the leaves rusting and crisping at the edges. I walk through Schiller Park with you on my chest. Stars smolder well into daylight. Look, the pond, the ducks, the dogs paddling after their prize sticks. Fall is when the only things you know, because I've named them, begin to end. Soon I'll have another season to offer you. Frost soft on the window and a portal signed there. Ice leaving the bare gray branches. The first time you see something die, you won't know it might come back. I'm desperate for you to love the world because I brought you here. Okay, and now we have an article called The Meaning of Mariah Carey. Finally introduces us to the real Mariah. The memoir, out now, is the pop icon's most personal project yet. The first time I can remember telling a lie, I was 7 years old. I was in line with two classmates about to walk into our second grade classroom after recess. While we waited, one of them plopped her fingers into my ponytail, which was even puffier and frizzier than usual after an hour of playing outside. "Why does your hair get so big?" she asked, as she tossed her own pin-straight, dirty blonde hair over her shoulder. I didn't understand the pit in my stomach that I felt then, but it was a sensation I would come to know well. "It's like that because my mom and dad both have really different kinds of hair," I answered matter-of-factly. "You know, like Mariah Carey? Actually, Mariah Carey is my cousin, and that's why my hair kind of looks like hers." As the words left my mouth, I knew they weren't true, but as I watched their eyes grow wide with wonder, I somehow felt satisfied. For a few weeks after that, kids would approach me nervously on the playground to ask, "Is Mariah Carey really your cousin?" before adding, "You do kind of look like her." Luckily, like most elements of second grade life, it was a story that would be forgotten within a few weeks. But the memory came flooding back to me as I read the first few chapters of Mariah Carey's new memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey. As is obvious by my desperate need to claim Carey as a family member at age 7, I've been a major fan of the pop star since I was a kid. Emotions was my very first cassette tape, one that was played out endlessly on a red, yellow, and blue Play School Walkman. In addition to her music career, however, I always saw a bit of myself in Carey. Growing up as the daughter of a black father and a Puerto Rican mother in the majority white suburbs outside of Baltimore, I was constantly looking for reflections of myself, any person who could help me better understand why I constantly felt like an outsider. So I vividly remember the first time I heard an interview with Mariah on TV where she called herself biracial, the daughter of a white mother and a black and Venezuelan father. From that moment on, I paid attention to her interviews, thirsty for representation as I waited to hear her talk about feeling other or not good enough, like I always did. Looking back now, however, in all of those interviews, I could see in Carey's eyes the same feeling I felt in my stomach that day when I was 7. The constant need to explain yourself and who you are, even though you know that no answer you give will ever be good enough. It was why, as a second grader, lacking the language to understand my identity, all I could do was cling on to the identity of a larger-than-life person I admired, a beautiful celebrity who spoke the same secret language I did, even if she, too, couldn't always express herself clearly. So the fact that after a decade-spanning career and more awards than she can count, Carey is finally opening up about it all in a memoir is cathartic, not only for her, but for me, and so many women like me who will see their younger selves in the pages of this book. The new memoir was co-written by writer and activist Michaela Angela Davis and released September 29th. And coming from a pop star whose brand has for so long been veiled by smoky mirrors, glamour, and a self-proclaimed diva title, each chapter is shockingly, but refreshingly, candid. By releasing her memoir, Mariah Carey is finally free. Many readers will, of course, want to pick up the meaning for the long-awaited true stories behind some well-known moments in Carey's life, and she certainly delivers. As someone who has devoured more celebrity memoirs than I can count, I can say that The Meaning of Mariah Carey is one of the most revealing I've ever read. Carey and Davis don't mince words as they describe everything from her infamous mental health breakdown in 2001 to her repressive marriage to music mogul Tommy Mottola, a romantic rendezvous with baseball player Derek Jeter, and her marriage to Nick Cannon and the birth of their now 9-year-old twins, Moroccan and Monroe. There were many moments while reading that I had to pause and reread because I was surprised at just how personal Carey gets. After so many years of letting the tabloids tell so much of her story for her, you can feel how just therapeutic every single word must have been. She gets so real, in fact, that about a quarter of the way through, I switched from my physical copy to the audiobook. Knowing that Carey herself narrates the audiobook, I had an urgent need to hear her tell her story. By the way, I highly recommend the audiobook experience, not just because Carrie's reading voice is just as alluring as her singing one, but also for the way she croons song lyrics we may not have realized were about a specific moment in her life. For instance, at the end of a chapter about her complicated relationship with the sister she used to make dandelion tea with, the emotion in her voice is tangible as she sings the lyrics to Petals. And I miss you, Dandelion, and even love you. I wish there was a way for me to trust you, but it hurts me every time I try to touch you. Still, for all of drama and revelations that sated my curiosity as both a Mariah fan and a journalist, to me there was nothing more insightful than getting to know young Mariah. By carefully and vulnerably sharing the details of her childhood with us, we finally get to meet the real woman behind the image of a diva. There are many harsh realities in these pages. Carrie describes feeling uncared for because her white mother didn't ever attempt to do her multiracial textured hair, which left her curls matted and her feeling unkempt for most of her childhood. She also recalls the time when her 6-year-old white best friend Becky burst into fearful tears when she met Mariah's black father. But most heartbreaking is the emotional abuse she endured at the hands of her siblings, particularly her sister, who once drugged her and often attempted to woo her into selling her young body to older men. By seeing all that Carrie experienced far too early in her life, we come to understand that diva image was created as a defense mechanism, a barrier to shield us all and herself from the pain she grew up with and still carries to this day. For years, Carrie has been an enigma, a shining, brilliant star as glittering as the diamonds she adorns herself with. Yet all along, there was something on the inside stopping her from shining as brightly as she could. Now, by releasing her memoir, Mariah Carey is finally free. And she's offering that key to freedom to readers like me, who have longed to hear her true story, so they can better understand their own. It seems she has finally, after all these years, become the butterfly she has always wanted to be. Next, we have an article called Isabel Wilkerson Recalls the Moment She Learned Cast Was an Oprah's Book Club Pick. When Oprah called Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson to tell her that she had selected Cast to be her latest Oprah's Book Club pick, Wilkerson was surprised and moved by Oprah's words. Oprah promised that she'd call everyone she knew to tell them about the book, which she said had touched her soul. Cast is a remarkable work of history, both a prayer for humanity and a way of seeing the evolution of inequality through an entirely new lens. It traces the roots of American racism back to another continent centuries ago and uses the metaphor of an old house to describe how we can begin to take responsibility for something we didn't ourselves initiate. Wilkerson's book also reveals that the Third Reich drew on Jim Crow-era laws to inform its own reign of terror and gives us insights into the role of endogamy in enforcing racist policies. Reading Cast, you may be astonished at what you didn't learn in high school or college about Reconstruction, Jim Crow, how and why race was invented, and much more. Cast is a product of deep and meticulous historical detective work and a masterwork of storytelling with the potential to forever change the way we think about inequality. So on the eve of the Oprah's Book Club announcement, I called Wilkerson for a conversation about why she believes Cast is a hopeful book, and of course, what it was really like getting that surprising phone call from Oprah. You say the idea of race, even the term Caucasian, is a recently created construct. What do you mean by that? Race, as we now know it, the idea of dividing people and addressing them as being white or black, is a fairly new language in human history. Before the exploration of the world by European explorers, there was no need to think of oneself on the basis of skin color or what one looked like. People were Italian, Spaniard, English, or Hungarian, but this wasn't connected to one's color. African peoples didn't need to identify as being black because that was not the primary metric of distinction between people. The idea of categorizing people by race grew out of the transatlantic slave trade and the arrival of different people from around the world to what would eventually become the United States. It was the convergence of people who might have looked different from one another that created the impulse to define people on the basis of what they looked like. Before that, there was no concept of race as we now know it. Race is only a concept that dates back 400 or 500 years. The idea of caste, however, is one that goes back many millennia. It predates race. Caste is an artificial hierarchy, a graded ranking of human value in society that determines the standing, the respect, the benefit of the doubt, access to resources through no fault or action of one's own. You were born to a position in a hierarchy in a traditional caste system. The reason I have chosen to look at our country through a different lens, that of caste, is because in this age of upheaval, we need new language and framework for these divisions. Seeing ourselves through the lens of caste allows us to see the X-ray of our country, to see our country through new eyes and allow ourselves to build a new framework for healing. Why do you avoid the term racism in your writing? In my first book, The Warmth of Other Suns, I wrote about the exodus and flight of 6 million African Americans who were defecting the Jim Crow South, essentially fleeing a caste system that determined the contours of their days and what they could or could not do. In writing that book, I realized the word racism was insufficient and did not capture the entirety of the social hierarchy of oppression. The idea, for example, that it was against the law for a black person and white person to play tennis together. The idea that even when African Americans were driving, they could not pass a white motorist on the road. There were such rules and restrictions at every turn about what they could and could not do, each of them designed to keep them in a fixed place. Therefore, racism, as it is often spoken of in our current day, did not capture the extreme measures that were taken to repress them. Caste spoke to the all-encompassing, comprehensive nature of this artificial hierarchy that keeps people in their place. You reference a historian who refers to Jim Crow as the Nader. Why was Jim Crow the Nader? The historian Rayford Logan described that era, which began after Reconstruction when the South reclaimed its control over that region after losing the Civil War, as setting in motion the restrictions of the caste system that I talk about here. It began in the 1880s, and it didn't end until the 1960s with the civil rights legislation. But the Nader was about 100 years ago when an African American was being lynched every 3 or 4 days in the American South, which is why the summer of 1919 was called the Red Summer. This was an era in which African Americans had no political rights, and they could come under attack for any tiny breach of the caste system. These breaches could be as simple as not tipping one's hat, not stepping off the sidewalk quickly enough. So Logan describes this time as the Nader, the low point of race relations and the life prospects, safety, and well-being of African Americans. What role does Martin Luther King Jr. play in how you tell the story of caste? In 1959, King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, made a journey to India because he had been so inspired by the nonviolent protest of Mahatma Gandhi. They arrived there, and he said whereas in other places he might have arrived as a tourist or a visitor, here he arrived as a kindred spirit. He was well received. He was invited to a school for children who were then called untouchables. The principal, very excited to welcome him, introduced him as a fellow untouchable from America. When Dr. King heard that term applied to him, he was a bit peeved. He did not consider himself to be an untouchable. But after giving it some thought, he recalled the experience of his people, the people he was advocating and fighting for, who were at that very moment not being given the right to vote. He thought about the positioning of African Americans in the states at the time, particularly in the South. He said to himself, "Actually, yes, I am an untouchable. Every Negro in America is an untouchable." He spoke about his revelation at a seminal sermon that he delivered at Ebenezer Baptist Church in 1965. He expressed his revelation, his recognition, that there was, in fact, a caste system in the United States, and that African Americans had been consigned to the very bottom of that hierarchy. Shifting gears a bit, can you tell us about what Oprah said to you when she called to tell you she'd selected your book for Oprah's book club? I was overcome by the generosity of her words. She told me that this was one of the most important books she had ever read. I was blown away by what she said and the language she used to describe it. It's so difficult to talk about now because it felt like a tearful recognition of what the country had been through. She told me it was exquisite, that all the angels are working with you on your side, that you are highly favored. She said in writing, I had responded to a higher calling, a calling from the ancestors, and that the ancestors were very pleased. I have no words for the honor she is bringing to this book. Caste ends with these words, a world without caste would set everyone free. It's a very hopeful sentiment. Can you explain what your hope is for the impact of the book? My hope is that we can see that these false walls of division were erected generations ago, centuries ago, and that none of us had anything to do with the building of these barriers between us. My hope is that through open-hearted understanding, through seeking to engage with the history, by a willingness to really look at our country, which I describe as an old house that needs constant work and reassessment and often repairs, that we seek to set right and transcend the divisions that were erected so long ago, to illuminate the walls so that we can scale them. One of the great consequences and biggest losses as a result of caste is that we don't get a chance to truly know fellow members of our same species. We don't get to see the many ways humanity manifests itself. This is our inheritance, and it's up to each of us to decide what to do with it. And now I'm going to share an article called The Rock Cried Manly Tears Over Joe Biden's Election. Many across the country are celebrating the election of Joe Biden with a big sigh of relief, including Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson. Back in September, the 48-year-old shared his support for Biden and Kamala Harris, making it his first ever public presidential endorsement. Following the election results, the Fast and Furious actor shared a video on Instagram to reflect on this milestone and the unity of the country. The Rock congratulated President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris on their historic win and said he waited to post about it because he was actually too emotional when the news broke. I cried a tear or two, or 10, but they were all very manly. All of my tears were very manly. The reason I got emotional yesterday was because of what I felt my vote represented, he continued. My vote represented my little girls. It also represented humanity, decency, and the principles and values Lauren, my wife, and I instill in our little daughters. And finally, my vote represented the importance of just being a decent human being. And to me, being a decent human being matters. Although the election had The Rock tearing up, he made note of all the work that still needs to be done in terms of bringing the country together. He made sure to express his support for those who voted for President Trump, despite getting a lot of heat from his followers with different political views. He ended the video, topping it all off with a brand new bottle of tequila, raising a toast to finding common ground and the end of a stressful weekend for the country. And here we have another article called How Kamala Harris Became Incredible Friends with Joe Biden's Son, Beau. She says, Beau and I talked every day, sometimes multiple times a day. We had each other's backs. When President-elect Joe Biden announced he had selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, it was a historic decision that will ultimately make her the first woman vice president, not to mention the first black woman, the first South Asian woman, and the first daughter of immigrants to hold the role. While Biden pointed to Harris's experience as a U.S. senator, California's attorney general, and a district attorney in San Francisco, as some of what influenced his decision, he ultimately acknowledged another factor, her relationship with his late son, Beau, who served as the attorney general of Delaware prior to his death in 2015. While I first knew Joe as vice president, I really got to know him as the father who loved Beau, my dear friend, who we remember here today, the vice president-elect said in her victory address on November 7th. The other heartfelt nod to Beau during Saturday's celebration, playing Coldplay's Sky Full of Stars as the fireworks went off. A friend of the family texted me to say this was Beau's favorite song, CNN anchor Dana Bash remarked during the network's coverage. They were both attorney generals at the same time. He had enormous respect for her and her work, Biden said in an email to his supporters, explaining his choice to select Harris. I thought a lot about that, he said. There's no one's opinion I valued more than Beau's, and I'm proud to have Kamala standing with me on this campaign. As it turns out, long before Biden announced Harris would be his VP, and even before their head-to-head battle as rival Democratic presidential candidates, the two first got to know each other through their mutual love and admiration for Beau. In 2011, in the midst of the housing crisis, Harris, then in her first year as California's attorney general, was under pressure from the nation's biggest banks, the Justice Department, and nearly all of her fellow state attorneys general to accept a much-anticipated settlement from the mortgage financing industry. But she was skeptical of the bank's initial settlement offer, in which California would have received $2 billion to $4 billion, saying it represented crumbs on the table. When she decided to pull out of the ongoing negotiations, friends, colleagues, and political advisors widely criticized her decision, with the exception of a few other state attorneys general who were equally unhappy with the initial proposal. That included Beau, who was then in his second term as Delaware's attorney general. Beau had every reason to keep his head down and toe the line, according to Harris's 2019 memoir. But that wasn't who Beau was, she wrote in the book. Beau was a man of principle and courage. As a result, Beau opened his own investigation into the banks, and they began sharing information. That's really where the two of them started to bond, Doug Gansler, the former Attorney General of Maryland, told the Daily Beast. She was sort of an instant rock star, as Beau was. They were destined to get together and collaborate. In the end, Harris's gamble paid off. Not only did she secure a significant increase over the original settlement offer, but she also gained an incredible friend and colleague in Beau. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.